to be Art Kemp from Claremont Men's College. When Art was working at the same organization with which I'm presently connected, he showed me a matrix that he was developing in which he had prescribed his own definition to such terminology as liberal, classical liberal, conservative, and a few others. He was nice enough to show it to me, and I'm sure my response was rather inane and not very helpful. But at a later time, he told me that he had shown it to Milton Friedman. And Professor Friedman's remark was, Art, have you asked any conservatives if this is really what they believe? And Art had to admit that, well, no, that wasn't the way he had written this. And I think the thing that called this to my attention was when Professor Herberg made reference to businessmen being a group of elite. I wonder, Professor, have you asked any of us recently? Sometimes we don't feel like we're elite at all. Sometimes we're not even sure that we're part of the human race. But the next speaker perhaps can clarify some of this, because I think all of us, certainly interested in the conservative movement, recognize that it is ideas which govern men's actions and not the other way around. And I won't repeat for you, for all of you must have heard it at least 100 times, Mr. Keynes' comments about people being influenced by ideas. Maybe our speaker today will indicate to us some of the process about how ideas are developed, at least insofar as it applies to his particular agency. The next speaker is, as you know, Frank Shakespeare, director of the United States Information Agency. His background indicates that he is a graduate of Holy Cross, served in the Navy during World War II, and maybe we'll ask Frank if he at one time felt if he was a member of the elite, because I see from his bio that he spent a few short years at least with Procter & Gamble in the industrial world. After the war, he began a career in broadcasting. He moved rather quickly through sales positions, sales manager, up to the general managership of the flagship station of the CBS located here in New York City, WCBS-TV, and later became a vice president of CBS. In 1968, he served as an advisor to a man's name who's been mentioned here once or twice already this morning, President Richard Nixon. In 1969, then, he was appointed director of USIA. One of the first things he did, I'm told, was to ask James Burnham to study the USIA book program. And as most of us are aware, this led to a conservative book list being developed. And according to the information provided me, in order to get a balance into the program, and I'm not sure what that means, because I think maybe we don't really need a balance. One of our speakers this morning indicated that in conditions such as those we face today, somebody has to get on an extreme side in order to keep the ship from tipping over. He also has traveled quite widely since he assumed this position in order to find out what is really going on in USIA programs in various posts overseas. Mr. Shakespeare.
You know, Lee, you were commenting about somebody giving you a definition of conservative and liberal. Some while ago in Washington, an old Democratic senator came up to me at the time that the Republicans were choosing their minority leader, and the battle was between the senator from Tennessee and the senator from Pennsylvania, as you may recall. And I asked this old Democratic senator which one he thought would win, and he said, well, that depends whether or not the party is going in a conservative or a moderate direction. And I said, well, that's just semantics. That doesn't mean much. What does that mean? And, of course, I fell right into his trap, and he said, young man, there's a tremendous difference between a moderate Republican and a conservative Republican. He said, a conservative Republican is one who thinks that nothing should be done for the first time. A moderate Republican thinks that it should, but not now. That's the Democratic definition, I might add. I must tell you in honesty that when Don Lipsett, who is secretary of the Philadelphia Society, as you know, invited me to come today to appear before the Philadelphia Society. I was not familiar with the organization. And believe me, it didn't help to be told that the Philadelphia Society of Indianapolis was meeting in New York. But I looked up the society, and an organization with officers like Henry Regnery and Ernest Vanderhag, and trustees like Bill Buckley and Gerhard Niemeyer and Jameson Campaign has to be worthwhile. And in a sense, I'm on home ground, because a number of your officers and trustees have an association with USIA, either directly or indirectly. Directly in the case of Bill Buckley, who was Nixon's first appointee to our advisory board back in 1969. Gerhard Niemeyer, because through USIA, he went to Japan a year ago this summer and spent about 6 weeks in Japan talking with elites and influentials in Japan about the United States. And that was an extremely helpful thing to have happen. And very indirectly with Ernest Vanderhag, because he recently went to Southeast Asia, and although he did not go under our auspices, we tried to facilitate his visit so that he got to see the people that counted in that beleaguered part of the world. And lastly, Jameson Campaign, with whom we've had occasion to counsel very recently. Because I didn't know anything about the Philadelphia Society, I took the occasion to read that little sheet that you probably send out to all speakers. And I noted really four things that you say, that you are designed to sponsor an interchange of ideas through discussion and writing, that your purpose is to deepen intellectual foundations of a free and ordered society, to broaden understanding of its basic principles and traditions, that in the process of doing so, you examine any issue, social, philosophical, religious, political, economic, and that your purpose is to seek understanding and not conformity. But when you read that and when you see the Board of Trustees and the officers of this organization, you have to come here. And so really, that's why I'm here. I noted that the theme of your Eastern meeting, which I gather this is conservatives and the media. Of course, that has to be your theme, because if it was conservatives in the media, you'd have a damn short meeting. I missed your morning panel this morning on the state of the conservative movement. I do want to hear later from some of you and your associates about how it went. I note this afternoon that you're going to have panels on both print and broadcast. I'm particularly interested in the broadcast panel, and I want to commend you on the two people you have. Edith Efron, I missed in Washington, where she made an announcement. She was in Washington last week to announce her new book, The News Twisters, and although some people from our organization was there, unfortunately I could not be there. And Tom Miller of CBS, who's president of the CBS television-owned and operated television stations, was a close associate of mine at that company when I was there for 18 years. And tonight, Herman Kahn, I suppose, will tell all of us where it'll be in 30 years. And most interesting, Bill Schlamm at lunch, Foreign Policy and the Press. I'm going to talk very briefly to you, change my plan just a little bit, because it occurred to me that maybe the most useful thing would be to have a Q&A longer than we might normally have, so that I can respond to specific questions and interests that you have, or try to respond to them. So I'll comment very briefly on just two matters, really, both swirling around the communications revolution. Now, what I'm going to say may seem quite simple. It is simple in its facts. I think it's fairly profound in its meaning and its significance. Basically, the premise is this, that the communications revolution that has occurred in the lifetime of all of us in this room has transformed, in some ways radically transformed, the premises on which a nation can now base a successful foreign policy. Now, let me back up and talk a little about what I mean. For centuries, nation states have conducted their foreign policy using essentially the interplay of two forces, that is, the economic considerations and the military considerations. And they tied that with their national goals and objectives. And through the interplay of those factors, they came up with their foreign policy and implemented it. Now, within really 25 years, one generation, something has happened which fundamentally alters that premise, and it's the communications revolution. Now, what do I mean by the communications revolution? Well, firstly, it's something quite mundane. It's technology, almost all of which came from this country. First and foremost, it's television, followed by tape recorders, followed by satellites. It's transistor radios, so that if you go to, as I did a little while ago, to northern Tanzania, you'll walk out really in almost the jungle land. And there alongside the road, you'll pass a Maasai, tall black warrior. And he'll hold his spear and he'll have a blanket around him. And he'll be walking along with flies flying around his head. Has been true, I suppose, for centuries, except there's one difference. And I was so startled that I stopped the Land Rover I was in just to look at it, because the Maasai that I saw had a transistor radio plugged in his ear. And so it is essentially a technological. Now, in its effect, what it has done is it has created a worldwide market for the rapid and impactful dissemination of information and ideas that has simply never existed before in the history of man. So much so, people know about considerations that relate to foreign policy. They know about it much faster. They know about it in a way which is much more vivid than ever before, and in a way which stirs their emotions more than ever before. And so they become emotionally involved. And becoming emotionally involved and laying on that the mercurial nature of people who are emotionally involved, you have an attitudinal factor of people which is making itself ever more self-evident throughout the world. And unless the government can deal with that attitudinal factor of people, its own peoples and foreign peoples, in relation to its foreign policy, it cannot conduct, or let me say it is very difficult to conduct, a successful foreign policy, and that's a new factor. Illustratively, simply two things. Southeast Asia. It was not essentially military considerations and economic considerations that have inhibited American presidents as to their options in Vietnam and Southeast Asia. It's the attitude of people. Well, that's now a truism. It's the attitude of the people of Southeast Asia, the people of Asia at large, the people of the free world, and perhaps most importantly, the people of the United States. Lyndon Johnson used to meet, they tell me, every Tuesday. And he had four people present. As I recall, they were Rostow, McNamara, Dean Rusk, and himself, in the so-called famous Tuesday luncheon. And that's where they made all the decisions about logistics and moving troops and supplies and even what targets to bomb and that sort of thing. And that's where the war, theoretically, was run, right from that little group of four. But I think they made a fundamental mistake. They never really thought about the absolute fundamental necessity of carrying the people along with them. And not having carried the people along with him, he in fact had to resign. And then take the question of the Middle East. The Middle East has economic considerations, of course. It has oil. It has military considerations, not only the power of Israel and the Arab states in confrontation, but the backup power of the United States and the Soviet Union, the Sixth Fleet and Soviet Fleet and other military aspects. So it does have the traditional economic consideration, oil. 90% of the oil of Japan comes out of the Persian Gulf, which is going to go whatever way the whole Arab world goes, probably sooner or later. 60% of NATO's oil, the opening of the Suez Canal. Those are tremendous economic and trade considerations. But isn't it a truism to say that unless the attitudinal relationship between 2.5 million Jews and 100 million Arabs can be made palatable reasonably to each side, there's going to be no solution? In other words, the foreign policy is not going to be successful. So I use only those two illustrations of Southeast Asia and the Middle East to illustrate that today there's a third leg on the stool of successful foreign policy. there are military considerations, there are economic considerations, and now there are attitudinal considerations. And that's a result of the technological communications revolution that has occurred fundamentally out of American technology and occurred incredibly enough within that instant speck of history, which is the lifetime of every person in this room. Now, the communists, in my judgment, are more aware of this than we are. And isn't that ironic? Because it was our technology that created it. And communications is tied in many ways, effective communications or marketing of ideas, to put it in mundane terms, is really right out of the American experience. Hollywood was the motion picture business. The United States was in the forefront of television. Madison Avenue was a worldwide symbol for advertising, that is, the marketing of ideas. And so the ability to relate to people, not only using the devices, but the very idea, the very thought of marketing, if you will, ideas or products or whatever, that really stemmed primarily out of the American experience. And yet, in the international marketing of the fundamental idea of what is man, where does God fit in, and where are we going? Those are the fundamental ideas, how man should govern himself. It's the communist world who probably spends much greater effort, and to some extent even more skillfully, than we do in the free world. I'll use a minor example. It's a small example, but it's illustrative of their thinking pattern and the way they do it. 2 days ago or 3 days ago, I forget, when the announcement was made simultaneously in Washington and Peking that Henry Kissinger would go again to Peking. What happened in Peking when that was made? Well, you've read it in the paper, but when you think about it in terms of communications effectiveness, it's little short of brilliant. Chu Enlai invites all Americans who happen to be in Peking to the Great Hall of the People. Now, that's very symbolic. If he invites all the Americans in Peking to meet him at this moment of all of the questions about China in the Great Hall of the People, that's front page worldwide. Who happens to be there? Huey Newton of the Black Panthers, John Stewart Service, a group of other people. So the association is, from his point of view, fortuitous. But what is the timing? While those people are in the Great Hall with Chu Enlai, which is of itself a worldwide story, he tells them that in 30 minutes there will be an announcement in his capital and in Washington about Henry Kissinger's visit, which absolutely guarantees now the electric excitement of it because it's got a peg. And then in the process of making sure that his story will now receive worldwide attention, he very skillfully puts the United States in the position of being a supplicant coming to see him and say it doesn't make much difference to China whether the negotiations succeed or fail, but they felt out of charity, in effect, they ought to see the representative of the United States. It's not only what he said, which is pretty much a straight line, but the brilliant, and I use the term with care, way in which he platformed it to make absolutely certain that all over the world it would receive front page news what he said. A good friend of mine who's somewhere in this room, Dimitri Danielopoul, has told me on a number of occasions that, as he has observed it, we often, in the United States and the free world, it's so self-evident to us that our way of life is better, that we sometimes make the mistake, and particularly governments, I think, make the mistake of presuming that truth in these matters is self-evident. The communists do not make that mistake. And so I simply leave you with a very sketchy thought, because I do want to go to Q&A, that the communications revolution, and I thought it would be relevant here because what you say in the preamble of your Philadelphia Society Constitution or whatever it is that you're going to deal with ideas and the discussion of ideas and the transmittal of ideas between people. And that's not only affected our society, that's fundamentally affecting whether this nation can have successful policies throughout the world. And so I'll leave it on that and go directly into a Q&A, if I may. What is your procedure for that? Do I just stand here, or does somewhere?
I think Stan has some comments.
Well,
do you want to go to question and answer?
I think that Frank wanted to do it effectively, so I'm sure.
Okay, we'll let Stan join in with some questions and answers and comments as we get into the discussion, rather than doing it on a formal basis then.
Let me say that I will try to answer questions on any subject that you want to ask about political or any other matter, and obviously not just what I've briefly referred to here this morning.
Would you stand and please identify yourself in each case?
Emerson Smith, what kind of impact do you make to your literature in foreign countries? Do you really get readership or just distribution of material?
Well, I think you have to distinguish. The question is, what sort of readership and impact do we get from the literature that we distribute in foreign countries? Do we simply distribute it, or do we get some impact? Mr. Schmidt, you have to divide, for me to answer that question, you have to divide the world really into three areas. One of the closed societies, the communist world. The other are the developing societies, which, for purposes of this definition, I define as those that do not have a sophisticated communication structure within their own society. And lastly, the sophisticated communication societies, which almost exclusively are Western European and Japan, although there are one or two others that possibly could be added to that. And the answer is different in all three cases. In the Soviet Union, as the citadel of communism, the only written material that this agency can put out is a magazine called America Magazine. We have an arrangement with the Soviet Union that was made under the Eisenhower administration whereby that country would publish in this nation a magazine, they call it Soviet Life, dealing with cultural affairs with a circulation limited to 60,000 plus 2,000, which you can send to elites. And that we would publish a magazine in the Soviet Union, which we call America, with a circulation of 60,000 in which we send to elites. How effective is it? Well, in the first place, it's widely known among urban residents of the Soviet Union. 60,000 in a country of 240 million is a joke, but that's what it's limited to legally, so that's what we deal with. We must put it out through a Soviet distributing organization and take their figures on it. Well, we do that with considerable skepticism. Now, the only way we can be sure that it gets any circulation at all is that we check the kiosks in some representative cities, maybe five or six cities throughout the Soviet Union, obviously Moscow and Leningrad, and sometimes Kiev and Odessa and places like that if we happen to have people there, as to whether or not it in fact is on the newsstands. Generally, they give a newsstand as little as 3 to 4 copies. There's a specific day on which it's distributed. And those literally are gone in 5 or 10 minutes. The minute that they go on the stand, they're bought by people. There's a black market price for America Magazine, which is the equivalent of about $3 in United States money, which is an awful lot for Soviet. We could sell millions of that magazine. It is literally a collector's item in the Soviet Union. But we're very restricted. Now, in terms of its effect, I'll only give you one little incident. I went over to Leningrad in July of 1969 to open an American exhibit in that city. And the first day was ribbon cutting, so that didn't mean much. The second day was the first day of the month-long exhibit. And it was to open at 11 o'clock. I got there about 10 o'clock. It will be of interest to you to note that by 10:30, there was a line of Soviet citizens 4 abreast running about 6 blocks for an exhibit on education, which is a pretty dull subject in terms of showbiz appeal. It looked like the line that you see around Radio City Music Hall when the Easter show is going on. And they were, you could see by their dress and their drab attire and that sort of thing, that they were average citizens. We let them through in groups of 50. When the first group came through, there was an obvious confrontation between them and the Russian-speaking American girl guide that was there. And when that was over, I went up to her and I said, "What was that all about?" And she said, "Mr. Shakespeare, they said that on the Voice of America this morning, we announced that we would give out back copies of America magazine as long as it lasted. And they aren't up yet, and they don't want to go through until they get their back copies of America magazine." Well, that's pretty impactful. I'll go all the way to the other extreme, to the sophisticated societies. Practically nothing we put out in written form of a mass appeal in the sophisticated societies like France and England and Japan has any impact whatever. The real impact in those instances is in elitist journals which we put out. You may be familiar, some of them, some of you, with one of them called Problems of Communism, which is a bi-monthly that we put out that tries to deal with philosophical trends of worldwide communism and also activist considerations of worldwide communism. That's done in a manner which is deliberately designed to appeal to elites, and it does so. We get that to editors, to publishers, to professors, to scientists, to that sort of thing. So in the highly sophisticated societies, the very thin band of men that we are have to deal with those who make publicity, if you will, rather than with publicity itself. And there's something in between in the other countries. Well, that's an overview. Yes?
My name is Mackinson, and I do find, of course, that you're moving out many of the things that were fluent in bringing out about the technological revolution in communications. I think that is a very important point that is significant. But I think you go beyond him. I'm not aware that McLuhan says that the actual nature of contact between people based on the foundation of principles and ideas has been really changed by communications media. He simply says they are able to be brought more effectively to larger numbers. That's changed a little bit. But I would like to ask you, you say that the media themselves, the technological media themselves that haven't evolved, are of such total fundamental seminal importance for spreading ideas and beliefs. How do you explain, for example, the development of something like Christianity, which was founded in a period in which there was no radio, no television, and no printing press? It was founded by a carpenter in a distant province, or, for example, Islam is the same thing, with a camel driver. This was done by word of mouth, by personal example, and has generated beliefs and principles that have lasted thousands of years. So I would wonder whether the very strong reliance you place merely on the technology is enough when you're dealing with something like communism, which is, in a sense, a new religion.
Well, I didn't mean to place confidence in technology, if that's what you interpreted me as doing. I will grant you for openers that the 12 apostles were the greatest propagandists that ever lived. But they had some support that's probably denied to us, too. A fundamental idea, whether it be something as very basic as what man is, or a very profound philosophical change, really the United States Constitution and all of that, will find its way throughout the world if the idea has merit. There's no question about that, and history is replete with examples. Technology doesn't change that. So in terms of broad, fundamental sweeps of history, technology isn't going to change it. But technology does something very important, however. Technology changes the time frame. It changes the time in which a government has to react, and it also can move with such immediacy as to impact events so rapidly. Another way of saying it, that governments must move within very rapidly changing circumstances. Also, in societies where governments must be responsive to the people, governments may fall or have their options limited. Now, those are very real changes. Whether they're seminal or not, no, not in the sense that you're talking about, not in the sense of Christianity or communism. But they're very, very real in the terms of a country within, say, a relatively short time frame, 10 years, to have a successful foreign policy. And it was that that I meant to speak to. Yes?
If I may, I have two critical comments on Shakespeare. I very much appreciate what your agency is doing. Oh, by the way, I didn't introduce myself. Ruby is my name.
Dobie?
Ruby, managing editor of a small publication with a long name, a religion in communist dominated area.
Yeah.
As I say, this is criticism coming out of the country occupied by the Soviets, Czechoslovakia. My brother, who is student of Chinese and Russian communism, spent 4 weeks and just returned recently. And
from where? From where did she?
Czechoslovakia.
Yeah.
And she was asked to give you this message, and it's only about 5 lines. Many people listen to BBC and Voice of America. They would prefer more news devoted to Czechoslovakia and Soviet blocs. You see, during the brief period under Dubček, they had an excellent coverage because Dubček almost reintroduced freedom of press. But since that time, now under Soviet occupation, there is no news. So they would appreciate more news about their own country because they don't know what's going on.
All right.
Complaints that Voice of America broadcasters do not speak distinctly. Most important news item discussed by people was escape from Czechoslovakia of the director of uranium mines. You know, uranium mines are exploited in an imperialistic and colonialist manner by Soviet Union.
And the director was a defector?
Yes, and Voice of America gave very little coverage to it. And second thing, your propaganda, America cultura, American culture, well, this kind of thing, the people told them in Prague is almost an insult to them. If this is supposed to be American culture, if I make just two sentences what they mean. The article on psychedelic art with the powerful cover picture and numerous illustrations serves its purpose. It confirms the allegations of communist propaganda that the Western world, USA particularly, is decadent and sick, and that such decadence is fostered by big business, AT&T, Bell Telephone Company, Scott Paper Company. We asked their opinion of some Czechs recently arrived in USA. They consider this article an insult to USA and to the sensibility of the leaders behind the Iron Curtain.
Are you, is that something, presumably, that USIA put out, what you
yes.
have there?
I have it for you, all translated and with comments.
Well, I'm not familiar with it, and I'll have to look at it, obviously.
I just wanted to ask you, how much control really you have about your people doing this stuff? And as I say, I said it because I broadcast the Voice of America for Europe. I am all behind you, but I just wonder sometimes what's going on, you see, and whether you know all the details. And I give it to you after.
Well, I've got a lot of comments to make now, I guess. let me try to take them in sequence. The Voice of America broadcast into Eastern Europe with specific reference to Czechoslovakia. It's the single most effective thing that the United States, single most effective reach weapon that the United States government has. The broadcast, the electronic means of going into Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. The reason for that is that the number of embassy people that you have in those countries is relatively limited. Their contact with the people is quite sharply limited, not because they might not try to make contact, but because people who are seen talking to attachés of the American embassy get in trouble themselves. So we get local citizens in trouble if we're in much contact with them. You can't get anything placed in the press, obviously, and their own local media is totally controlled. So what that strips down to is that the one way that the people of the United States can talk to the people of the communist society is through the electronic media, which in this case means the Voice of America. All right, now, what do we do about that? We broadcast into the Soviet Union every day in eight languages. The eight languages are the four so-called big languages, that is Russian, Ukrainian, Armenian, and Georgian. The three Baltic languages, that is Latvian, Estonian, and Lithuanian, and in English. So we go every day in those eight languages into the Soviet Union. We go in almost all of the indigenous languages of Eastern Europe, Czechoslovakian, Hungarian, Polish, Romanian, Serbo-Croatian, Slovenian, that sort of thing. How effective is it? You can't tell. And the reason that you can't tell is because you can't do any research surveys. Coming out of CBS 18 years, where you live on those much maligned ratings, which really is just a measurement of approximately how many people are listening or watching to something at a specific time, you can't take those in those countries. But you get a mosaic of impressions which can eventually create a picture for you. I won't go through the detail of that here, except to say that it's one of the things that I looked at most carefully when I went in to this assignment, and I am quite persuaded that the reach and impact is very heavy. Now, the reason for that is twofold. One reason is that people in those societies have short wave. You and I think of short wave as an anachronism. It's like listening to Paul Whiteman on a crystal set. But in those societies, either distances are tremendously important. For example, in the Soviet Union, broadcasters measure distances by time zones. There are four time zones between the United States, East Coast and West Coast, or 3 hours difference in time. Well, in the Soviet Union, there are 11 time zones. So it gives you some idea of distance. And therefore, propaganda through radio by medium wave, propaganda now being technical reach, simply doesn't function. So in order to get out into the very broad reaches of a country that is that large and doesn't yet have a sophisticated infrastructure, they must use shortwave. Shortwave, therefore, is standard equipment in the home of a Soviet citizen. In Eastern Europe, the condition is not quite the same, but all during World War II, the only way that those people could get information about the West was through the old gray lady, the BBC. And so even in our movies, we saw that they hung on the BBC all the time. And indeed, they did. And so that's one reason, sort of the technological and habit reason. And the second is the enormous hunger for any information from the West. What's going on in the West? Those of you who visited there perhaps know, but when you go into those countries, and particularly if you get out of the capitals, for instance, if you go to Bulgaria, you go to Sofia, you feel like you're at the end of the world. But when you go to Plovdiv, which is a second city, you're off the planet entirely. And so in terms of any knowledge about Western society, and therefore you have an enormous hunger on the part of the people to find out what's going on. All right, all of that is by way of saying that the listenership is there. We have all sorts of indexes and indices, some covert and some overt, that give us that impression. All right, now, then what do we say, which goes to your question. I might add here, and I think this is quite important. In Eastern Europe, the five essential countries of Eastern Europe, I leave out Eastern Germany and Albania. In the other five countries of Eastern Europe, Radio Free Europe goes in. And Radio Free Europe is in some trouble in this country because of congressional action. This group could be enormously important and should be, in my opinion, in rallying support behind Radio Free Europe. It needs it. You have other voices of the West. You have the BBC. You have Deutsche Welle, which is the German radio. You have Kol Israel, which is the voice of Israel, and that sort of thing. But essentially, we're talking here about VOA. Last thing, I'm taking longer on this than I thought. Another reason for the listenership to VOA, which is your radio station, is because at this point in time, it is understood that we are the citadel of the West. We are particularly the citadel of the West in military terms. And so it is not important, it is sometimes absolutely vital to know what the United States is saying or doing, particularly as you approach a crisis point. So as you got to the Polish riots last December, people were hanging on either Radio Free Europe or VOA to find out what was going on in their own country, which for the first 2 days their own press was not telling them, and what was happening in the West, and most of all, what was the United States saying and doing and thinking. Now, that's the arena in which we operate. What do? Basically, we try to run a very straightforward news operation. We do that because when you say, this is the news has to basically be credible. And we try to run a first-rate, objective news operation, which simply relates to what is happening. Now we have a little problem with that, because there are two or three things that interest people. One is what's happening of worldwide significance. I mean, let me take this down into specifics. If you're in a small village in Czechoslovakia, what interests you on the Voice of America? All right. You're interested in worldwide developments, particularly worldwide developments that could in some way impinge on your life or your society. But even if it can't, you want worldwide developments. What's happening in the Middle East, any big major development. The second thing that you're interested in is developments within the United States. And the third are developments within your very own society. Now, I go to the question of credibility. We can be absolutely sure, relatively sure, on the reporting of world developments that we know the facts. We can be relatively sure on reporting of developments in our own society that we know the facts. We have to be very damn careful when we report about internal developments within a country that's a sealed society, that we know the facts. Because if we're wrong on something that they know about in their own country, it will shatter their credibility in the things that they don't know about. So we tend to be very cautious, maybe too cautious for your purposes, on internal developments within a country. Whenever we're sure, we hit it and we hit it hard. But the first rule is to be sure, because you can't tell a man what's happening in his own backyard and be wrong and expect him to believe you when you tell him then what's happening 5 miles away. So that's the reason. Now, insofar as the allusions in that, if we have said that, I'm obviously shocked by it. It's hard for me to believe, and I'll only say that I'll look into it. I can't go any further than that.
One more thing.
Yes.
Bill Schneider from Senator Butler's office. I just wanted to make one comment on Radio Free Europe, et cetera. In June, I was as part of a congressional tour in Poland, and I got a number of briefings by foreign ministry sources as to how Radio Free Europe was a major impediment to better Polish-American relations. Through non-official sources, I questioned people about Radio Free Europe, and the indication was that they listened to it and to a significant extent relied on it. So
sure.
I would just try and reinforce what you said about backing them up, because they are a major problem in the Soviet bloc.
They broadcast, by the way, in Poland, which is that where you were?
Yes.
To give you an idea, in Poland, Radio Free Europe broadcasts 16 hours a day. We broadcast in VOA an hour and a half a day in the Polish language, because they are only concentrating on five countries. We're concentrating on the world. But RFE is really the number one radio station in Poland, as I think you found out. The deputy prime minister of Poland, when I was there in 69, told me flatly. And remember, this was in 69 when Kissinger was still the Chancellor of Germany, before the Brandt government. And he told me flatly that although he knew that as head of USIA, I didn't have anything to do with RFE, he presumed that if the United States wanted to do something about RFE, it would happen, the government he was talking about. And he then went into what could only be described as a 10-minute diatribe about the disruptive effect of Radio Free Europe. I came away from that convinced that we had a terrific weapon in it. I'll just take one more from that gentleman. And
I was wondering how you would illustrate your theme of the having to deal with the third leg with regard to Nixon's announcements regarding the economy and, say, his visit to Peking. And in doing so, what we can expect from the government as far as how they're going to present things to the people or how they will respond and how we might be effective in taking part in that.
Gee, that's a long question. I don't think I can treat with that just in a couple of remarks here. In treating with Peking in this society, which is so open, you'll draw your own conclusions and treat with it in any way that you see fit. In the way we treat with it, you really can't be of direct help to us, but we can be of help to other peoples, illustratively. We just completed the transmitters in Tanang in the Philippines. For those of you who have any familiarity with radio,